Well, I first want to thank my colleagues because we don't get to see each other except in these kind of circumstances. We're sort of a virtual organization. And I do also want to say that if it was up to us, we would have all of our Rwandan colleagues presenting to you today because we really try to, as much as possible, support Rwandan colleagues to speak for themselves and for our staff too. So we have been able to successfully get them to a lot of different conferences and a lot of exchanges in the United States and elsewhere. And that's one of the pieces that I think we all feel quite proud about. And so I just am greeting you today on behalf of our partner associations. They have basically allowed us to speak to you on their behalf and for them and with them. But we somewhat represent the United States side of the REACT project. And I also want to acknowledge our colleague, Dr. Kathy Anastos, who really is very involved in the scientific and medical programs with Dr. Cohen. My name is Anne-Christine Dedeschi, and I'm a journalist primarily for long background, but also a pretty open activist and advocate. And as Marge noted, I really got involved. One of those moments when you're going along in your life and you just say, you know, I have to stop at this one, I have to do something different. And I had been starting to write about what I was learning with regard to Rwanda. But even as somebody who had been working for a very long time in HIV, I have to admit to you that I really was not aware of how many women had been raped in the genocide and the extent to which they were dying. And it really surprised me because I'm somebody who is very involved in this field. And so, you know, there were 250,000 women who we are estimated were exposed to HIV, were raped in the genocide in that 100-day period. And of them, estimates are very difficult to get. But somewhere, you know, one of the best estimates from a sort of small sample was that maybe 67% were exposed to HIV. But the fact is we're not going to know the numbers. And of course, HIV was present. I think what struck me was the fact that there were not very many women who were openly positive and speaking out at that time. And today, there has been a quite significant change, but still the voice of positive women in Rwanda is something that is emerging, and it's something that we have focused on in our program. So we've come at this from a problem-solving approach, recognizing that we have some skills and things to offer, but really wanting to learn what we can do with the particular groups that we work with. What are their resources? How can we come in and support them? And I think that from my perspective, one of the ways that I've positioned myself within REACT has been to focus on community mobilization issues, education in particular, and the question of advocacy. So I wanted to present today some of the lessons that we learned from Rwanda because as we've been doing the Rwanda work and as we've been feeling excited about some of the successes, of course, we've been, like all of you, I'm sure, in the room, very aware of what's going on in the DRC, right across the border, what's been happening in Darfur and Sudan, recognizing that this history, what we think considers history, is repeating itself, and what should we be doing? What can we learn from Rwanda? And that's where I have been focusing myself in this last year. So I'm going to kind of fast track through these slides and start a little bit with one or two things from Rwanda in order to really talk a little bit about what we're seeing now in the Congo and also what we consider to be parallels, sort of trends emerging in post-conflict situations like Kenya and newly Zimbabwe. So as I mentioned, one of the things that Marge mentioned as well is that we've really created a medical and training bridge between government and local NGOs. One of the focuses is the education. And this is true both for the HIV piece and the sexual violence. The fact is that even though there's been a long movement for HIV in the United States and Western Europe, in Rwanda, the entry of people into that movement has come at a different point. It came at a point where medicines were just beginning to be available. But all of the piece of work that was done here in the United States, the infrastructure for NGOs to address HIV, all of the idea of having an HIV-positive identity, that piece was very new for Rwanda. And so we really have to acknowledge that their journey to become sort of a movement around HIV or for those people who identify is very different. And so it's kind of like this rapid learning that's taking place. I compare it to the way that people have just gone directly from, you know, no phones to very good smartphones and learning to use them. And so they've been able to skip the, you know, the dial-up slow services and things like that. We've mentioned some of the things, and I think the piece here on the bottom, the income generation, is the economic stepping stone. One of the lessons that I've picked up and I'm sharing, and I think is I'm seeing is also true for the DRC in particular, is that we have really found that, I think Mary would talk about this and Marge too, that even in these associations, which have existed for 10 years in some cases, which are created as self-care groups, women weren't necessarily disclosing to one another that they were survivors of rape or that they were positive. There was no safety. Sometimes those were mixed groups. They didn't know where another person was coming from. And the fact is, in Rwanda, genocide is present every day, and people are constantly being released from prison. So the issue of security is constant. It's not something that suddenly is relieved because this genocide happened 10 years ago. And so this issue of safety was very complicated. Where would they begin to speak out? And we found for a lot of them that it was really not in necessarily the support groups which were set up to do that, but it was in the income generation groups where they were first of all allowed by their families to come because they were working and there was a reason for them to not, you know, have to be somewhere. In other words, they had to be working, they have to make money. And so that created a great space. And we've seen a lot happened for those women within the context of an economic project that is really a psychosocial piece, a healing piece, a disclosure piece, and that's been important. Another lesson I learned was that many of the women did not want to participate in the justice process. I mean, they wanted justice, but there was nothing positive for them in anything to do with justice. They were stigmatized. Lots of things happened, which Marge mentioned as the sequelae of what happens when you experience sexual violence. There's the physical and the mental problems, but then there's the other things. Immediate, you know, given many of them became widows and lost their property. Their children were stigmatized. They had to, in some cases, abandon children, even if they were children of rape, all because of this issue of stigma. And much of it because rape does not happen to the woman. It happens also to the family. And so recognizing that, I think, and taking this family approach is really necessary. But for the justice piece, we found that many women weren't interested in justice. What they wanted was treatment. For them, that was justice. They wanted to live. And once they got treatment, they still didn't want to do anything with the courts. But once we were able to get their children in, and then they saw their children were going to live, then they had a motivation to start thinking about other things. They wanted to have wills for their children. They maybe wanted to get the house back that the relatives had stolen. So it's very important to recognize that people are going to enter this process at different times and that our services have to be catered to that. So I think that for me, the economic piece is a really much more of a starting point than it would have been if I had to go back and do this again, you know, 4 years later. The other thing was, and we've mentioned this, the issue of trauma. When you're exposed to HIV because you think it's a result of sexual violence and you're reminded of every day, seeking HIV services, deciding to stay on treatment, wanting to talk about it, all that is a constant trauma. So trauma counseling is an integrative and ongoing process for our HIV work. I also mentioned down here the needs of boys, and this is something emerging in the DRC in particular. It's something less visible in Rwanda, I think, but we'll talk about the DRC, where so many boys have been taken, but we're finding a lot of sexual violence happens in the prisons right now. There's a lot of HIV exposure, and that families don't bring boys even into the police the way they do for girls. So that there's a real need to focus on the sexual violence perpetrated to boys, but also boys as perpetrators or men as perpetrators. And that, I think, is a big issue in Rwanda that is just being addressed more and more. But I think we are starting to work with men, and we found that engaging men to be leaders against sexual violence, I mean, we really can't turn the men away. They want to be involved in this issue, and they want to be seen as not only the perpetrators. So I think that's a piece of work that we have in front of us, and we're excited it's beginning. We're working with one of the Rwanda men's groups that's formed, and we're seeing that they're coming in through the legal channels. Lucy mentioned in terms of the authority figures is another piece of it, where these men who are engaged, who are the elders or whatever, are ready to play a role. And that's the same thing that we're starting to see in the DRC. So I'm going to go to some of those slides now. I also want to mention, as Lucy mentioned, that very few cases of rape are prosecuted, but rape is very stigmatized. In other words, if you accuse somebody of a rape, that man will immediately perhaps be outcast, will not be able to work, et cetera. So there is actually something to look at there in terms of what are ways to be able to think about protection and prevention, and that's an ongoing discussion happening among our partner NGOs. I think that Marge has mentioned this too, rape, and Mary, that rape is continuing for many of the survivors. people are being released from prison. Rape is happening again. It's actually something that is a real pattern. In places like the DRC, we're seeing just an absolute crisis of ongoing rape that takes place even after women are healed again. So I think that the other issue is the rape of children in foster care, which our NGOs have asked us for help with and looking at. In other words, they want to come to their solutions about this, but this remains a major issue. I think the one piece that wasn't talked about that I've encountering in the DRC a lot, and again, there's culture, is the issue of what happens when a woman is raped. I mean, one piece is the economic, which is that the woman loses her status if she's a young woman in terms of being marriageable. And certainly in some cultures, for those who are Islamic, there's the loss of the dowry. And what we're seeing in some of the groups that I've spoken with in Rwanda and to some extent in the DRC is that this economic piece, that bringing the woman and giving her own means of making her money, in some cases means that she'll be brought back into the family, the husband will accept her back, so that this economic piece is again very critical. It may not be the way that we would want to think about how that problem should be addressed. In other words, we would wish that the stigma didn't exist, but the fact is that it provides the family with a way to address one of the pieces, which is the loss of the economic status of the woman as a result of the rape, and the loss of the family too, the children. The Democratic Republic of Congo, I'm going to go quickly through this. The reason I put a lot of these slides is you guys can take a look at them later, but I just wanted to pull together some of the statistics. Women in the DRC have been coming and asking for information about the model that we have, hoping to implement similar models, wanting to know what they could have done differently, what should be done now. And I think that what we have been able to see is the structure that we chose of working with NGOs and providing more of the training at the level of the NGOs is a great way to go. Clearly, people know their problems, and in many cases, they have their own solutions. I think we would all agree that that's where we have taken a big lesson. We thought that was true, and we've learned that in Rwanda. The other thing is that in the Congo, this issue of the ongoing and the fluidity of things, that there's movements taking place, so that many of the people in the DRC were actually people who were in Rwanda, suffered the genocide in Rwanda, went into the DRC, and are now suffering from that ongoing. So it's a regional problem, and it also deserves a regional solution. And so more and more of the NGOs are thinking about how they should be working regionally, outside of just within their country or within their local organizations in a district in a particular country. We don't know how many women in Rwanda, but we know the DRC, the numbers are very high. And I'm just giving you this one statistic because it's an actual survey that was done by the Global Rights Group. But it's extraordinary. And I do want to call your attention to the fact that in Goma now, and you've probably seen this past week, the rapes are going up again as of August. They're seeing increases in the number of women arriving as a result of a process of fighting that's taking place. So the situation is very acute now. And our partners there are actually urging us all today and at this session, in other words, to let you know that your voice is really needed right now, to raise this attention in the US to the increase that's taking place and their needs. Fistula is something that I have been looking at with regard to the particulars degree of physical damage that's done to women's bodies, and we've been working with one group called Heal Africa in Goma. They have an all-Congolese team. They have been doing many of the things we've been doing in WEAC. I think the main difference is that they've come at it more from a religious orientation and less from the empowerment. I think now they're moving more toward that and are integrating and hoping to work with us to integrate the legal advocacy piece. But one of the things that I think is very important is that even today, after being there for a long time, and so many groups in the Congo, as we found in 2004 in Rwanda, none of these women are actually getting HIV treatment. There's not any of the women getting treatment from the government, and there's very few NGOs providing it. The children are getting some treatment care of the Clinton Foundation, but I think that it's just unbelievable with so many groups going there and so many NGOs involved that we still haven't been able to find a way to provide HIV treatment for the percentage, the still relatively smaller percentage of women who are actually going to need the HIV treatment as a result of their exposures to rape. The stigma issue in the DRC is very similar to Rwanda, but I think that what they're finding is that moving away from the idea of focusing on this as an individual woman's problem, which has been kind of the traditional approach of the public health system, and focusing on it as a group issue is something that is helping them. They're beginning to be able to think about identifying this more as a national problem, and that seems to be helping with stigma. And that's sort of based on my conversations with women, actually, and some of the counselors at the Heal Africa group and some of the groups I've been speaking with lately. Only a fraction of the rapes are reported. Obviously, that's true in Rwanda, and it's true elsewhere. And one of the reasons is that, with the stigma, but also because of the conditions that are required to sort of, quote, document. People can't get to clinics to document rape, and it's just simply not secure for them to do so. Heal Africa is starting a gender justice program, and one of the things that they want to look at, which is something I've been looking at post-Kenya and post-Zimbabwe, is what could be done or given to the associations like those we work with. What could be given to the community health worker who receives the woman who is arriving to report a rape? And there are some tools that would help them monitor and document what's actually been happening with sexual violence, and also better link them to services from groups when they come in. We've found that some of the tools that exist are things that are done, that we've done, which is to make sure that they have women who've got some trauma counseling training but can take a testimony, use things like pictograms, and that those are tools that we will find stand up later in a court of law if they decide to press a claim. So these are some of the emerging tools that the DRC are considering. I'm going to go to Kenya just to talk about Kenya, because we talk about wars, but we don't look at the civil conflicts. And in Kenya, there's been incredible escalation. And I think the trend in Kenya is one that they're seeing and starting to document in the DRC, but there's still fighting going on in the DRC. But certainly in Zimbabwe, it's true, which is that actually you see an escalation of sexual violence as peacetime comes often, or as things calm down. This has been true in Kenya. They've had a huge escalation of sexual violence. And one of the things in Kenya that really struck me is that they had no, even though they had had a sexual violence unit, they had no preparation within the NGOs for dealing with a large scale, what we call the epidemic or systematic use of rape as a tool. Same thing in Zimbabwe. So that there were a lot of NGOs there, but they hadn't been prepared. They hadn't learned from each other. So I think now what they're looking at is how to share these lessons between NGOs. I'm going to take one more minute to give you a final conclusion that I've seen here. This is a shift from conflict-driven rape by unknown to known assailants. Many of the studies that are now emerging show that in the beginning, in Kenya, as in Zimbabwe, rapes occur because it's the police, it's positions of authority, it's the militia. But then as it establishes itself and settles in, it becomes more and more from people that they know. And this has also been what, in Goma, they're documenting, in Bukavu, they're beginning to document. And it's something that was talked about in Rwanda, so I think it's an important area to look at. Kenya has concluded that every country should develop an HIV emergency preparedness plan, but that it really does need to include a local plan, and that bringing together the local NGOs to look at that is something that they should have and wish they had done. The other things are some tools that we've seen, cell phones in particular, are emerging as a key tool for both documenting and also a rapid response to communication. And I think that they mentioned the use of videos, that's also something that is being used a lot in the DRC to have women document their own stories. Finally, some of the tools that really are needed there are the range of things we've seen, educational materials, GBV training, rape kits, et cetera. We've seen certainly trauma counselors in Kenya. They're also asking for needing trauma counselors. We've seen this now. And I'm just going to finish with Zimbabwe, to ask you to pay attention to what's happening in Zimbabwe. There are some reports that are going to be coming out in the next few weeks about Zimbabwe. There's a very, very serious escalation of sexual violence directed at particularly those women who are identified with a political party. And so we're hoping to be able to, again, share lessons. And there are some groups like AIDS Free World, which is the Stephen Lewis group, who are working with some lawyers to try to document Zimbabwe. But my final point here is to say that I'm encouraged by the level of emerging leadership that we're seeing and how quickly things are turning. The acuteness of the sexual violence and the devastation it's causing also, you know, the sort of silver lining that happens is the result of this awareness of sexual violence, some of the changes of laws that we're seeing in places like Sierra Leone and Liberia, we're now seeing in the DRC, new laws being written, an awareness that this is a culturally and socially rooted problem, but that it's also causing and lifting some of the silence that there's been around rape and sexual violence, domestic abuse, child rape, the role of foster care, et cetera. And we're seeing men now engaging in that conversation. So there's forward motion despite the scale of, you know, attacks and sexual violence that's been directed at women, particularly in children, and also, as I mentioned, younger boys and men. Thank you.
That's great. We'd like to open up for questions now. I think the perspective of how gender-based violence sort of has to be addressed as a very large, complex, but an entity that has a human rights and women's face agenda. We sort of tried to provide for you how our experience in Rwanda and what our Rwandan colleagues have showed us, that that's a possibility, that you can actually create a program that actually we think is sort of a women's human rights approach. And we hope we sort of made that clear for you. But we welcome your questions, so, yep. I think the question was related to, have we seen in WEAC the, not from WEAC, but what the efforts are in the country related to reconciliation? Is that the question? Has our work helped anything related to reconciliation? Yeah, I think we all agree here that the issue of reconciliation in Rwanda is way, 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 way past WEAC, and that it's very difficult. And there are lots of different ways to approach that issue, us thinking about it and talking about it here. I don't know, you read, Kinzer just has a new book out, which sort of implies that the work and the road that Kagame has followed in Rwanda is building towards that in the best way possible, and it's on its road. We see every day examples of how that's not, that's continuing the difficulties, and we see it in staff relationships. We see it in staff and patient relationships. We see it as patients tell us what's happened in their community. It's been 14 years since a total horrible genocide happened. I don't think you would expect that there would be resolution sort of at this time, and the country's issues related to reconciliation. You know, there's some people who are, you know, were manifold, were in Arusha, where there was the international courts, and then locally where there were Gachacha hearings. The results of all of those methods have been not exactly what everybody would want. So I think there's still a road to go. Our experience with the reconciliation part, actually, I think, on a patient level, what the women tell us is, we sort of want to move forward. We want to have our kids go to school. We want money. We want food to eat. And, you know, maybe the next generation will have a different experience related to this. Other comments? Is that sort of fair? You want to say something? If you want.
Just real quick, I agree with what Marge said, but two things I'd like to add. There are individuals in the country that, in my view, are really asserting extraordinary leadership. For example, one individual who we all know witnessed his family members murdered during the genocide. And he has made a personal decision that the only way that he can really move forward is to very publicly forgive the perpetrator who still lives in his community. So the last time I spoke with this individual, he said he was planning, he wasn't quite sure when the moment would occur, but he wanted to pick his moment for maximum effect so that people in his immediate neighborhood and community would observe this act of forgiveness. It's not any sort of government-sanctioned or non-governmental organization project. It was a personal decision that he made. And I think that's extraordinary. And I think there are a lot of people in the country who are stepping up in ways that I personally don't think I would have the personal courage and fortitude to do in a genuine way. So I think that's one point. And the other point about this whole notion of reconciliation is that it's going to take a long time, no matter, you know, what they did or how it was approached. It's just way too deep, and it's just going to take a long time.
Comments? Go ahead, Catherine.
I'm just so impressed with the
Well, thank...
There's 26 people in the room.
Yeah. Did everyone hear the comment? I want to thank the commenter for her comment. And Marge is reminding me that each one of us in this room can take these ideas and use them in our professional and personal lives. But I think it gets better than that. Actually, I was inspired in part by Anne's work and the work of many others and the ideas of others about how we could do this integration, but also inspired by a wonderful project that is based in Boston but has spread like wildfire throughout the United States. And it's called basically the Boston Hospital Medical Legal Project. And they started out by working with local legal aid organizations in Boston, bringing them on site to the hospital first and then the clinics. And it's been a very successful collaboration on both ends because, you know, as a lawyer who represents these families, I'm dealing with an eviction case, and you really kind of, you know, dig down and you realize, my God, this is an eviction because this family had medical debt and went bankrupt. And that's really how we got onto the whole practice of healthcare in legal aid, was through eviction practice. So it's been very helpful on both ends of the equation. And that Boston model, they have a website. I think it's, you know, if you Google Boston Medico-Legal Partnership Program, you would find them in many cities now and communities in the United States. They provide technical assistance to those who would like to start something similar. We want to take them internationally, but that's another story.
So, all right, go ahead. Oh, I was just make a quick comment.
One second. Oh, I didn't see
this.
Hang on one second.
I just want to make a little comment about the just to distinguish the question of justice from legal. That I think we're seeing a huge demand for justice in all these countries, in Sudan and DRC particularly. And the real question is emerging, what relationship does justice have to a legal process, especially when you don't have good legal structures or you have legal instruments that at the international level that have no bearing on the lives of people. And so I think that that's really going to be the big, that is really the journey, is to say, how do we support the person who has survived or the family's device to define what they consider to be justice and allow them to be able to make that claim. Some of our women, it's for them, like you say, to be able to forgive someone. Another person, it's that they want HIV treatment. Another person, it's... So it's really going to be that I think, at least I focus my attention on, you know, what we would call their definition of justice and not... I mean, as important as I think the legal piece is, and if anything, the one thing that's emerging in the DRC, just in this last 2 weeks or so when we were at a session together on prosecuting sexual war crimes at the higher level, is this move a little bit away from thinking of this individual case, and the fact that these are mass cases. We should be looking at this as national crimes, and how do we address a national crime, in particular when many people cannot come forward or provide evidence for that crime due to the issues of stigma. And I think that that's going to be a big piece that we're going to see in Sudan and DRC now coming forward.
Let me start with the last part of your question. In that case, he did go to trial. So there was an actual criminal prosecution. Right. Well, in the society generally, in sub-Saharan Africa generally, dealing with this belief of the cure about sex with a virgin is obviously a huge issue. And if you're suggesting, and I think you are, that maybe one path, well, the idea that you're giving me is that perhaps one path toward confronting some of these issues from a preventive perspective might be to challenge those beliefs. That seems logical to me. I think that part of the challenge in these countries is having an effective public health education program generally, and that would certainly be part of it. I don't know if we act in particular, others here know much more about what we do in terms of public health education, whether that's part of our curriculum or not, but it seems to me that that is certainly a path to consider. In terms of, the question about why it is that people are chasing a widow and her children from the family property, the beliefs may be part of it in terms of, what people, will they get infected if they stay in that house or are there ghosts or whatever. That may be part of it. I think it would be an interesting medical anthropological project to look into. But frankly, in our experience, I think it's pretty clear to us now that it's really a manifestation of the lack of power that women and children have in the society. I think it's very clear because it's usually, in the case of a spouse who dies, it's usually the in-laws who come in and, chase her away and expropriate, if you will, her property for the paternal line. So I think, for us, it's pretty clear, and from the research that I'm reading about other countries in sub-Saharan Africa and other human rights organizations who are confronting this issue of gender-based violence and HIV stigma, that seems pretty clear. The good news in Rwanda is that the Constitution, which was just enacted in 2003, so it's quite a new document, and it takes time to implement, obviously, these new principles, is quite good on gender equity. And better yet, in my view, the government has been pretty clear, messaging very forcefully, that gender-based violence is not part of the new Rwanda, and that inequality, discrimination against women is not something that's part of Rwandan society. So that's enabled our community leaders, the people that we're educating with this legal information, to really make some inroads. Because it's such a hierarchical society, it's kind of counterintuitive, but because it's such a hierarchical society, when the perceived leaders, the authority figures in the society, are messaging positive approaches, it makes it much easier for the community associations to really have that implemented. In addition, there's a system there of great respect for elders, and they have a tradition of working with, they're called the Abunzi. They would be the elders in the community, usually men, to whom disputes are brought. And bringing those people on board has been very helpful. That's basically how our community leaders are able to mediate these disputes.
I think the question was, this, like I said, we could sort of are beginning to feel like we can't turn men away. I would be interested to know more when we talk to our family groups and things, but certainly we're finding this. I've actually been finding this pretty consistently in South Africa and men I've talked to in Uganda, that there's definitely a big and emerging men's movement. And it's been interesting because it's such a flip where on some level, it's that men, they still want to be often in charge, and the society, in particular in Rwanda, it is patriarchal, so men are ready to feel like they should be in charge, whether it's leading the group or saying what's going to happen. But recognizing that men can speak to men in a way that women can't speak to men, and particularly the men feel comfortable speaking to men, it's created this space for them to do something that's very positive. And so we've seen a great interest in men being trained. And a lot of men, of course, you know, have been very much also suffered in the sense of seeing their mothers and their sisters sexually violated, or they themselves. And so I think it's a big area. But I think the other thing is the stigma. We've seen, and this happens continually, I hear, whether it's by email sometimes or whatever, but colleagues who are running these NGOs saying, you know, that the parents are much more reluctant to bring in the boy. There's the stigma of homosexuality that may come in, but it's really violence. It's this issue of the shame that comes upon the family. So as shameful as rape is for a woman or a girl, it's just in that sense even more so because of the society. But I've seen changing, and I feel like there's, again, because of the boys, HIV positive boys, there's also that leadership that's starting to emerge, and there's contact between the international groups now and across Africa. So there's really lessons being learned, and I think that Rwandans in particular are starting to have a voice in that. We've seen one men's group emerge. It's come out of the religious groups who are saying that they're mobilizing the pastors, because people definitely have to go to church, and it's one place where you definitely will get men to go. So it is a new and successful tool that they're beginning to use.
Appreciate it. Thanks very much, and thank you all for coming.